He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Well, hello to our listeners for this week's show of Car Keys with Jada Markin and Robin Leach. We are in the middle of fall. The weather's getting colder. In a recent show, I discussed the situation with car tires or vehicle tires in general, trucks, cars, whatever, anything that's inflated. It happens to apply to soccer balls, too, which I am imminently familiar with because I'm, besides doing this show, I'm also a soccer referee, which may or may not interest anybody listening. But we have to make sure that they are the balls are inflated properly if we are going to a game with temperatures that are below 50, even 60 degrees, and we don't know whether the balls were inside when they came out to the game, and there's specific balls that are used for soccer games. So we have to measure the pressure inside, and we have little mini pumps to pump them up to the required pressure for soccer balls. So to that end, that's what the show with all the tire pressure discussion that went on recently was all about. And I just wanted to continue and say one more thing to that, and then I want to go into something else, which we will do. Regarding tire pressures, as happy as I am with the Jeep system versus the Audi system, which I suggested was the Audi system was very complex to find out, A, what tire might be low when you started a car and saw their tire light on versus the Jeeps, which you can scroll into a menu which shows all four corners of the tires and their respective pressures, and therefore it allows you to find and then when the tire pressure light comes on, it tells you which tire is low right off the bat. So you know which tire to fill as opposed to going around and checking the pressures independently with a tire gauge. To that point, the problem, the nuisance with the Jeep side is for somebody like myself, your host here, is that if I leave the setting on the menu that shows the tires and pressures, I tend to, as I drive along, watch the pressures change independently. And that may mean you wonder whether if you see one corner of your four wheels at 25 and the others at 26 and maybe 27, after you've supposedly put, let's say, 26 pounds in, do you have to stop and get the ones that aren't staying even with the others inflated? The answer is no. Tire pressures will change if you are parked in the sun on one side and in shade on the other. The sunny side tires may be 1 or 2 pounds higher than the ones in the shade, and so on. And the same goes when you're driving along roads once you start your car up in the morning. So the moral of this particular part of the story on tires is that you can't get too insane about trying to keep the pressures at one evenly set level once you put them all up.
Don't look at the tire pressures on the gauges.
What?
You're saying to keep your eyes on the road and quit looking at the tires.
That is part of it, yes. And the other is just don't get compulsive about trying to keep the pressures same all the time, because it's not going to happen. Because of the various parts of components of driving and the weather factors. That's that on tires, everybody. I hope I don't have to mention it again for some time.
I don't think so.
The other thing I was going to bring up, Jay, if you have any comment, go ahead while I'm thinking about something else.
I just had another great weekend at another Cars and Coffee, another car show in the southern part of the state of Connecticut. And this one was a Porsche-themed car show. It wasn't really a Cars and Coffee. It was more like a Porsche than beer, because it took place at a brewery. And it was a pretty organic organization. It was this Porsche shop down in Stratford had organized this and just pretty much just put a posting on Instagram. And there must have been, I don't know, over 100 cars there. And just some very, very cool cars, and also some very cool people. And for those of you who know Porsches, there were actually two Porsche Carrera GTs, which is the hypercar that Porsche made in 2004 and 2005, if I am correct. And it was
fossil-fueled, correct?
Yes, total fossil fuels. There might have been one or two electrics there. But I
meant the two Carreras you're talking about, as opposed to maybe a hybrid version, and I'm not sure what models Porsche has in any kind of hybrid version.
No, this is 2005. There were 2004. There were no... This is okay. Real hypercars with a V10 engine and a manual six-speed transmission.
Wow. Okay.
And I was told there were like 600 of them total imported in the country. I'm not even sure there are that many. And there happened to be a half a dozen in just the southern part of the state, which is not really surprising. But there were more, plebeian Porsche 996s like mine. There were 997, 993s. The entire, from the 60s up to today, mostly 911s, but there were a few SUVs too. And it was a beautiful day, great show, like I said, great people. And car shows do still attract people. And we saw this at Lime Rock last weekend. We see it again in the southern part of the state. And actually, a Porsche Club actually had a car show elsewhere in the state yesterday as well, I think. So you mentioned cars and coffee on Sunday mornings, and people will show up. They drive in.
They talk about
their
car
for a couple hours. They compare notes. They look at each other's cars, and then everybody goes home.
Is there anything about ownership knowledge that comes out of that for not only the specific brand of car whose coffee clutch you may be attending, but cars in general, other cars in general that would be interesting to listeners in terms of maintenance or what to look out for as car wear goes up, meaning miles go up and all that? Is it just about how fun they are to drive, yada, 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 without getting into technical stuff?
In this particular, and Porsche is a special breed, right?
Yeah.
They are sports cars or were originally sports cars. Now you have mainstream SUVs. But there were two Porsche shops there. One was specifically prepares cars for track use and race cars, and the other shop is actually more about tuning street cars and maintaining street cars. People who actually get away from dealerships and find specialty shops who work on specific brands or models, and. In the case of Porsche, nothing is really cheap when it comes to maintenance and repairs. But
that's true.
But these shops tend to be more cost-effective than dealerships. In our area, you find specialty shops as well. We both know shops that work, on either all brands of vehicles or specific vehicles, and are cost effective and know the product really well. And I'm going on a tangent now and talking about maintenance and repairs. I'm always surprised that in this one particular shop I go to where you would think that because things have become so sophisticated and full of electronics and cars and all that, that they can't handle it. And it turns out that the younger generations of mechanics are actually pretty well tuned into all of the electronics side of things.
Right.
And there's plenty of software and website and support out there for these independent shops to be able to handle, high-tech cars.
Conversely, may I jump in quickly? I have discovered, to the point of independent car repair places, that they are actually, some of them are actually better than the new car dealerships as our cars get older. And the mechanics there in the dealerships, the mechanics that used to know about the older cars, and I'm referring in specifically to a car I own, which is a Jaguar, which is 2004. But you go in with my car And you, if you go to a Jaguar-specific dealership, I have found, or an Audi dealership, for even that, if the mechanics are not have not been around long enough to have had experience with our older cars that are not as electronically connected, et cetera, they new dealerships, the new mechanics really aren't as equipped to handle old, you know, and I'm talking 20 to 30 year old vehicles, which I happen to own some of, when you take them in. Either the mechanics aren't equipped knowledgeably in their heads to figure things out, or maybe some of the equipment that the dealerships used to have, and maybe there are, you know, not a handful of cars that may still be on the road around for them to service, that they are not very useful going, taking your Jaguar or old Audi or old anything to. To your point, Jay, the independent mechanics in many cases can be a great advantage to the dealerships who sold these cars, not to mention that in many cases I find they will be more economically more economical to repair in the total cost and run thing, even though hourly labor rates are now between, you know, $100 and $200 an hour at many independent shops, and they are over $200 an hour. In one instance, I know specifically a Jeep dealership in Florida at $275 an hour, if they actually book the hourly figure in the time it takes to repair a vehicle that they may be working on. So, well-meaning positivity is being addressed by me and you to independent repair places, a lot of them whom are, well, some really good ones that are in our Northwest broadcast area. Would you agree?
Yes, totally.
Yeah. Okay.
How's the industry doing? Oh, by the way, new website I discovered this morning.
Get your pencil out, people.
Visor.vin, and I don't know much about it.
What is it called?
Visor, V-I-S-O-R dot VIN. And
is VIN, V-I-N,
are,
like VIN number?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they, what do they advertise?
What are they offering on their website?
Not just pages of listings. See the whole market. So you can enter a model, a VIN number, or even a license plate. And I did that with my car. I plugged in one of my license plates, and it will give you, if not a Carfax, it will give you some information about the car itself. Like I plugged in my car plate for my Volkswagen Touareg, and it told me that the last information they had on it would dated back to 2016, and that it had been sold by a dealership in Georgia, which is where I bought the car. So I don't know. Like I said, I just stumbled upon it this morning, and I haven't really looked at it. But part of it looks pretty interesting. Part of it looks just pretty scary, because it's just like, you know, you can pretty much find out a lot about everybody's car.
Well, that is true. And to another point, for listeners, if you buy a used vehicle that has a trip computer in it, or a navigation system in it, you can also find out a lot of interesting, at least points of places that your vehicle may have been to before you ended up in your hands. For instance, and I have mentioned this in a show a long time ago, I wanted to put in my home address just for fun, and I was setting up the trip computer, or the GPS. And I found out that this vehicle that I bought had originated in Michigan. I bought it through Carvana, and it was a Jeep. And it not only told me that was – and I found that because I found a whole inventory of addresses that this Jeep had gone to, including the owner's home address.
That's pretty scary, huh?
Which brings up a couple of suggestions to people if you're going to let your cars go, more or less, sort of like if you're going to replace your cell phone, your old cell phone, with a new cell phone, is if you want to not want this information to get into somebody else's hands, whether it be a cell phone that might be sold, or reseller reconditioned phone, which I've bought several of over time, or a vehicle, you want to clean out all that information before you let it go out of your ownership or hands.
So, Robin, have you followed what's happening in the industry, like sales and how car companies are doing, both American cars?
Yes. I'll chime in on that because, yes, I read a lot about that in the weekly automotive news that I get, and I was looking for the latest one for this show, and I didn't find it. But the industry is doing remarkably well.
Are you sure you're reading a recent copy of automotive news? Because I don't see it as doing really well.
That's what's coming to a change, I think, Jay, and I will get to that. As I say, I think when they first started out and we were all concerned about tariffs and Mike jumped in and said, don't worry about it, it's not going to be a big deal, he turned out to be sort of right in part at the first 6 months of the tariff industry. Are we more than 6 months into the tariff world? I'm not sure. But in any event, I believe then dealerships stocked up on a lot of inventory, every piece of inventory, new cars that they could get. And the importers with the cars that are actually not built in either North America, which may or may not include Canada and Mexico, but Europe and Asia, I felt then that the tariffs were going to be have more effect on the pricing of the cars that were built in Europe, actually built and assembled in Europe or Asia, than being built and assembled in the United States of U.S. parts. I think that's changing, and I think we're starting to see the prices. There's sort of a forecast that prices are going to go up, and we're in 2025 right now, soon to be in 2026. The dealers have had a lot of time to sell vehicles. And there's been lots of advertising about pre-purchased vehicles that were tariff-free by Subaru and lots of the manufacturers. Those ads are disappearing in terms of availability of vehicles that were tariff-free. So everybody's been very conscious about the cost of vehicle ownership as well as financing them, and that is not good for the industry going forward. I have to believe. You want to add to that?
Yeah, well, I think I'm just reading about, car companies cutting jobs, like Rivian just laid off, I think, 600 people, and it's directly related to the fact that sales are down.
Right.
GM has paused the factory that produces their electric platform. I forget what the name of it is, but Ford has also
restructured it downward too.
The Lightning the F-150 Lightning
production is way down.
Yeah, and so my first reaction is electric vehicle sales are way down. And yes, they are, and BYD in China had a bad quarter too. But I think it's more than just the electric industry.
I think it's way beyond just the electric industry situation.
Yeah, I think it's the car industry in general.
I think it's going to be across the board in lots of other items from vehicles. I think the vehicle industry is in for a possible, if not dangerous, worrisome slowdown coming forward. I've noticed that the manufacturers in the U.S. are now back at the 0% financing interest rate mode of advertising, which I didn't see for quite a long time. But they offer, instead of dollar discounts, they offer you 0% financing cost charges. And it's very easy. I forget what the dollars per thousand of borrowed is, but it's a flat, whatever it is, it's a flat along the way based on the price of the vehicle. There's also cash backs that are back in vogue for vehicles in lieu of low-priced financing rates. So all the magic, Jay, that we have seen in the auto industry for how to sell vehicles is coming back online. as maybe sales are slowing for one reason or another.
Okay, so let's be a little less doom and gloom and look at the positive things. Have you followed what's the Tokyo Auto Show and all the concept coming
out? I have not.
Concept cars. I'm just looking very briefly, and you know, there are a few interesting concepts out there. One of them is like a six-wheel minivan / SUV luxury vehicle from Lexus, which is interesting. And you know,
posed for production.
Not
poised,
anywhere.
I
Whoa.
Should say. Poised, not,
in your not
life, posed.
No, but what I found interesting is that, first of all, the minivan / SUV, you know, a format, size of a vehicle is still what luxury vehicles are going to become, I think. We've seen luxury vans in Japan for a few years now, where level of finish and luxury is unbelievable. On another note, I just read a test review of the new Rivian, not a Rivian, Lucid. The Lucid, what's the name of the SUV?
Yeah.
It's a very large car. It is fast, comfortable, very expensive, and I'm sure in its class of cars it's going to sell very well, even though, you know, there are...
Well, it will sell very well to the wealthy who can afford it.
Yes.
And that may not numerically mean that a lot of vehicles will
be
on the road.
Enough. It's not going to be enough to keep Lucid
going
in the long
term.
That's
for sure.
Back to concept cars. I'm trying to see what else there was. Totally lost the page.
Well, while you're thinking about that, let me go let our audience know something that we are stewing about maybe bringing onto this show, which will be possibly periodically user experiences on one of our shows. We'll invite the users of specific vehicles, maybe that of people we run into, to come on this show, taped, telling us their experiences for specific vehicles we might like to know how they responded to and during, let's say, long distance cross country cruises. Electric vehicles are a primary interest to me because I have been ranting about the time that you have to take to charge vehicles when you can't drive 700 miles days with only coffee stops and brief food stops, as opposed to recharging times, which have been can be long in some cases and relatively short in others, but also limiting you and the freedom to drive between the charges. If you want to take a side trip when you're on an interstate going from, let's say, here to Chicago, and you suddenly want to go, you see a sign for something that's 75 miles north of and out in the boondocks of some state you're in, and you look down at your charging level left, and you worry about whether you can get up there and whether there'll be a charging port there. And all these electric cars come with indexes of where charging stations are, and they are increasing in numerically all the time. But I don't know whether or not you can actually plug a destination in the computer of the car before you actually head for that destination and find out that there are no or one or X number of charging ports up at where you're going that may be off a main route where they are fairly reliably have charging stations available for you to stop and charge. The example that I hope is going to show up in the show will be a Rivian usage, a Rivian owner, family who has recently taken a so-called cross-country and back trip in their Rivian, and they had a wonderful experience. But they also had they offered to come on this show and give our audience a chance to hear about firsthand experiences, the pros and the cons. So, Jay, that might happen to you when you have one of these fancy cars you drive. That maybe it's worth having that owner report in on what he likes about that kind of car, whether a Lucid or a Rivian or a Porsche or whatever.
But, sure, let's have some guests on.
For our audience, that may happen. So you can stay tuned and keep listening if you want to find out what we're going to pop up with on a future show here on Car Keys.
So as we near the end of the show, talking about driving and safety, and just read an article about a new traffic circle in West Hartford, Connecticut.
Oh, where is it?
I don't know. I know it's in West Hartford, but I saw a video of it and I saw pictures, and it is just ridiculous. There was a whole news.
What does ridiculous translate to for our audience?
It was built with hardly any elevation change in the middle of the circle, and these stupid arrows painted on the ground that just give the wrong idea of what to do in the circle, and then they were surprised that people actually drove through the driving circle. So
well,
then they put barrels all around the driving circle, so now it looks like a construction site, and they've restricted the amount of space for larger trucks to be able to maneuver around the circle. Anyway,
okay.
The problem with driving circles is the design has to be consistent. The rules of the road have to be consistent. One of the few really good driving circles around, I think, is the one we have in Great Barrington, which is really well designed. You can see it. You don't drive straight through the intersection. And it's pretty simple. You go into the you do not have the right of way going into the circle, and once you're in, you do have the right of way.
Well,
when you exit the traffic circle, put your signal in the direct to the right and exit. It's not complicated.
Okay, it's not complicated, and it was fairly well designed. I agree with you for our audience's information that they did a fairly good job doing it. The biggest issue was going to be for tractor trailers. Anything that's long like a tractor trailer has to have a wider range of turning radius to be able to effectively do that without cutting off the center of a traffic circle with their trailer.
They also have bigger tires, and that's why the Great Barrington circle works really well, because there is curbing, but then there's a next level up, if you will.
Okay.
Where cars are not supposed to put their wheels on, but trucks can go over that part, and that's
right.
Fine.
The trailers
really
can
well.
Drag over that point. There's a circle in Goshen, which has, to a certain degree, some of the issues you said about the one you saw in West Hartford. And what they've solved is, during the summertime, I find that they've got arrows and protective stands on that to keep people from crossing that. But in this wintertime, when it's plowed, they have taken some of those portable stations, so to speak, control stations, down, or they've moved them in so that there was not, I don't know whether you could actually cross through the center, but if you had trouble getting around it because of weather-related stuff, they were trying to limit that problem by removing things that might get in the way of plows trying to plow the roads to keep it clear. So you're right. They need to learn how to design these traffic circles in a raid. Are all the traffic circles in Europe wonderful, Jay?
No, they're not all wonderful, but they over the years, and it took time.
It takes time. Of course it does.
It takes time for, first of all, to figure out what works and what doesn't work, and it takes time to come up with a design that works, you know, consistently.
Right.
And it takes time for people to get used to driving traffic circles. When I go back to Europe, it takes me a while to get really proficient, if you will, to navigate the circles.
That's true.
So I get it. It takes, you know.
Okay. Some trivia before Mike chimes in and says we have to close, listeners, audience. I have a Hyundai Sonata, and this is going to interest only those of you who are like me. It's got just shy of 120,000 miles, and it has one of the things in its menus is average speed, which I have never reset since I've owned the car. The average speed that I have apparently driven this car over its almost 120,000 miles And this includes lots of highway driving at 70 and 80 and sometimes 90, just for short bursts, 36 miles an hour. That's 120,000 miles at roughly 36 miles per hour is what I think all my vehicles are doing. I can reset some of that in some of my vehicles, so I can't tell you that they're all, but they're all, so the moral of this is probably that your average speed in any car you're driving is probably going to be between 30 and 40 miles an hour over the life of your vehicle.
I think this is true, but I also think we are privileged to be living where we live, because in most parts of the world, they don't even come close to that because they crawl for hours in traffic every day.
Like California.
All right, and on that note, you have run out of miles.
So, to our audience this week, stay tuned for maybe some guests discussions on vehicles, mostly vehicles, we hope, and other trivia and other things suitable for car keys. This is Jay DeMarkin and Robin Leach saying goodbye.
Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.